Politics and Politics, Episode 4, A Blue House with a Blue Window.
Yo, listen up, here's the story about a little guy that lives in a blue world. And all day and all night and everything he sees is just blue, like him inside and outside. Blue his house with a blue little window and a blue Corvette.
Untitled by Gabe July Ross.
Test, test. So I guess I must have been about 12 or 13 at the time, because my mom picked me up after school and to drive me to the synagogue to train for my bar mitzvah. And this was something I really didn't want to do, so the drive was a very familiar one. I kind of created this atmosphere of tension. I would always argue. I'd be like, Mom, I don't want to be doing this. And she'd just be like, please just do it for me. And I was kind of whatever. And I just remember this drive in particular because I was in the middle of a sentence saying something along the lines of, why are you making me do this? And, before I could finish the sentence, I felt different. And it's hard to explain now exactly how I felt, but I became very aware of my breath and how short of breath I had become. I had difficulty breathing or kind of taking in the proper amount of oxygen or something. And then also, it felt all of a sudden as if I was pulled out of my head, stretched back and viewing everything through a mason jar with leftover milk film. But everything just, felt really different. I just kind of stopped talking, and I was quiet. And my mom asked me, Gabe, are you okay? You're quiet. And I was like, yeah, I'm fine. From that point on, I felt a certain way. But at this point now, 8 years later, I'm unable to recall how I felt before, so it's kind of resulted in me just being unable to recognize exactly how I feel, but knowing that something feels really, really off. And I was really scared at the time when it first started happening. I would look things up on the internet about my symptoms and, come to some sort of scary conclusion or think that I was going to die. And I was always too scared to, face the future. And so I sort of began to alienate myself from those who cared for me, especially my mom and my friends. I kind of began to be on a more superficial level with them because they would ask me how I felt. And I was kind of unable to tell them how I felt because I was scared. And so I, felt like I was lying. And now I'm at this point now where, it's been so long since I've felt this way. It's been 8 years. I know nothing different. So it very well could just be all in my head. And that's kind of what I hope it is. But I've gone to see, even therapists or just, talk to people. I'm still unable to acknowledge the fact that this could be something physical wrong with me. I'm just, too scared. When people ask me how I'm doing, which is, relatively, I guess, pretty good, I'd still want to tell them how I feel, which is one of two ways usually. I'm either very kind of distant, I feel like I'm floating above myself, watching myself act, and things are just being said, and I'm feeling certain ways. And since I've felt this way for so long, I kind of find myself getting flashes of moments of the past, because I wasn't maybe in that moment then, and I'm kind of experiencing it now. Like, one moment I could be 14 and upset with my mother for asking me how school was, or I could be just like sitting in front of my computer video chatting with someone who's showing me their naked body for the first time. The other, which is me being like too far in my body and hyper aware of all my body's functions, and it just really freaks me out. I can really feel my lungs opening and closing as these kind of like weird flesh sacs, and my blood pumping. I just really see my body and myself as this series of organs, and it kind of leads to a lot of confusion, and I end up seeing other people this way, and it just gives me this kind of weird outlook on life. When people ask me how I'm doing, even just in passing, I just kind of want to tell them how I feel. And I'm having a hard time even realizing how I... But yeah, I mean, when... I'm just getting kind of sick of how I treat the way we greet each other. I'm sure a lot of people feel this way, but I just feel that when I say, hey, how's it going? You know, like, I'm kind of just waiting for the other person to be like, you know what? I feel this way, and like just start talking, because I need someone else to open up to me and make themselves vulnerable first, because I'm afraid to, you know, not be okay and seem like I'm not okay. I feel like I just like look like this 20-year-old guy when really I feel like a scared 12-year-old who doesn't really know what's going on any of the time. And I'm good, like I'm doing all these things, like whatever. And I have a hard time getting to that next level or reaching another level of intimacy with people, because I always feel like I'm holding something back. And I, you know, oftentimes I'm in social situations and I just get quiet.
My book is My Body, by Tovarina Sterling.
The past ground of a battlefield had the force of human flesh on budding flower. Abrasive erosion of unearthed ground, saltwater tears that snag shards of innocence like broken glass menagerie. How is it we can compare it to any other piece of land? I know you feel the way a battlefield can. In seventh grade, I moved to a public school for the first time, and I made two friends, but they were anti-friends, which aren't your friends at all. They beat you up. When you walk through the streets, you walk like a combat zone. Your anatomy is a memoir written in stone. They made a lot of comments about my nose and my mustache and my weight. I remember they would pinch my fat. They told me that I had a rabbi nose. These were not Jew-loving people, so definitely can say not a compliment. I remember going home and I had this ritual where I would press my nose against the wall for 20 minutes a day to try and flatten it out. I had a jar under my bed, gorgeously labeled, nose job money. That was until I saw a YouTube video of a nose job. Basically, what happens is they take a scalpel or a lancet and they rip your fucking face off. So after that, nose job wasn't a thing. Don't fool yourself into thinking the matter surrounding your brain is inanimate. Your hips are stitched to the side with memories like those baby blankets we clutch because we love the smell of lotion and ignorance. After that year, the two girls left and I didn't have any friends. That was almost worse, but I continued to have this obsession with my looks. I told myself that I didn't deserve meaningful relationships because if I wasn't beautiful, I wasn't worth taking up space. There's a lot of body positive stuff out there that tells women that they should love their bodies because everyone's body is beautiful. And while I think that's a valid response, it's also a linear response to a complex issue. The problem isn't that women feel insecure about how they look. The problem is that we're stripped of all other positive qualities until our self-worth is put into how we look exclusively. We need to take the attention off appearance and start treating women like multifaceted human beings rather than just objects for some straight, cis, white, patriarchal, heteronormative male gaze. I, like a lot of women, look at Maybelline commercials and TV shows with, you know, women deemed societally beautiful. And I tell myself that it doesn't affect me. But it's far deeper than just the media. When I was a kid, I played with Barbies instead of trucks. I talked a lot more about clothes and makeup, and my looks were the first things that adults would give me feedback on, and girls' bodies were the primary things I heard boys talk about, and I bet you that even when I was a baby, people would make gendered comments about the way I looked. This obsession with female bodies exclusively is just interwoven in my life. I've wasted so much time contorting my body into something that I hoped that someone else would want. And that's a form of internalized oppression because I spent so much more emotional labor fighting my body than I do fighting the system that objectifies and tears down my body. All I wanted to hear when I was a kid was that I was beautiful. But what I really needed to hear was that I'm so much more than just the way I look. How your body absorbs scars like thimbles of rain in a waterfall. Throat paved with the words that almost choked you. The earth knows because she went through what you went through. No one could say you are not beautiful if they wanted to. Strip away skin. Strip away muscle from bone. It doesn't matter. You are golden threads of ecstasy. They cannot take you down with any amount of weaponry. You are woven with stories. It is not chemistry. You carry your book. For your book is your body.
Untitled 74 by Jesse Neal Cleopatra Moon.
My parents were both addicted to heroin at varying degrees for a very long time. It wasn't just heroin, it was cocaine, pills, and crack. But heroin was their main drug of choice, and heroin is what killed my mother. I was brought to A&A meetings with her at times when she was sober, and listened to stories and ate Oreos in the basement of the church with the other kids. My siblings and I were taken from our parents' care when I was 5. Abusers typically report feeling a surge of pleasurable sensation, a rush. The intensity of the rush is a function of how much drug is taken and how rapidly the drug enters the brain and binds to the opioid receptors. With heroin, the rush is usually accompanied by a warm flushing of the skin, dry mouth, and a heavy feeling in the extremities, which may be accompanied by nausea, vomiting, and severe itching. After the initial effects, users usually will be drowsy for several hours, mental function is clouded, heart function slows, and breathing is also severely slowed, sometimes enough to be life-threatening. It's kind of funny. This is what my anxiety feels like. The dry mouth, heaviness, nausea. In my family, we deal very mechanically. We don't expect support from each other. We make jokes. I always rejected therapy until recently because it reminded me of being forced to attend A&A meetings and participate in parts of the program when my mother thought I was misbehaving. I never liked being told how to feel. I have always feared a loss of control. I have always feared a loss of control. After my mother's death, her flaws were erased by the family at large, but in quiet, hushed conversations with only my father and my uncle, we could shake our heads and say, "What a shame." I'm not afraid of drugs because I know exactly what they do. I'm not afraid of drugs because I know exactly what they do. It scares me to think that addiction is genetic. It scares me to remember how close I am to becoming her. It scares me that I miss her now. I have always feared a loss of control. I have always feared a loss of control. I've always feared a loss of control. Reports of heroin use surging in America are everywhere. Heroin-related deaths have quadrupled since 2002. Mostly, these addictions begin with prescription painkillers. Once those are no longer available, people turn to heroin, which is basically a stronger, cheaper, and more accessible version of morphine. When I got my wisdom teeth taken out, they gave me a whole bottle of Vicodin. I threw it in the trash when I got home.
Untitled by Anita Rockefeller Fuentes.
I'm from Madrid, Spain. I was born there and grew up there. I lived in the U.S. for a while as a kid. Then I moved back to Madrid. Then I came here again and stayed. But I consider my home to be Madrid. I speak Castilian Spanish. Some people would call standard Spanish. Though the more I think about this concept, the more I realize it's wrong. My Spanish is also considered to be accentless, because I pronounce everything the way it's written, the way it's supposed to be pronounced. I speak correctly. I make no mistakes, according to the Spanish Royal Academy. But what is correct and what is incorrect? Just in Spain, there are four different languages? Castellano, Gallego, Euskera, Catalan. And then all the dialects, all the different accents. That just in Spain. Now think about Latin America. There are countless variations within one same language, and yet Only one version of it is considered correct. But why? Why is this? Why don't we find other dialects written in academic papers? Why do textbooks teach us to speak this way? Why is it that Madrileños and Castellanos find other dialects funny, but get so offended when others make fun of their way of speaking? Why do I experience those feelings myself? I'm obsessed with correctness. I am a perfectionist. You will seldom see mistakes in my writing. I guess I'm good at sticking to the rules. Spanish makes me feel at ease, at home. I don't feel any pressure to speak correctly, because I have the privilege to be naturally correct. I'm not scared of saying words I've never heard before out loud. I don't have to think before I speak. I always raise my hand in class. I always have something to say. I am less facially expressive because there's no need to be. I can just express myself in words. English is so frustrating because I can never be sure if I'm pronouncing it correctly. I feel like whenever I go back to Spain for the summer,
después de haber estado tiempo en Estados Unidos, y me cuesta adaptarme a hablar en español todo el tiempo, y digo términos que se traducen del inglés o que no funcionan en español, o falsos amigos y tal. Y entonces mi madre pues tiene este miedo, ¿no?, de que voy a perder el español.
When I go to Spain for the summer, I forget all my English. It's scary how easy it is to forget a language. It takes me so much mental energy to readjust to English when I'm back in the States. Sometimes I wish people didn't tell me I have a cute accent. I wish strangers didn't ask me where I'm from after 30 seconds of talking.
Son capas
layers of imperialism.
En Ecuador está Loja at the top. Que en Loja hablan tal cual hablan en España. En Loja hablan con la J y hablan con la Z. Después Quito, después otras regiones, después Guayaquil. En realidad el español de Guayaquil, que es la ciudad grande de Ecuador, de la costa, también es como vergonzoso en Ecuador, porque shameful. Hasta más distante del español correcto, apropiado, o sea, de España.
Incorrect.
Pues otras regiones, las partes pobres son shameful. Hasta menores. Pero esto incorrect. Está encima de los idiomas indígenas.
Shameful.
Y después le dices el quichua, y abajo incorrect. Otra, y abajo otra, abajo shameful. Otra, y abajo otra, y abajo
incorrect.
Otra, abajo otra.
Shameful. Incorrect. Shameful. El español está debajo del inglés. Obviamente.
Anda que se puede. ¡Ya, ya!
Yo, listen up. Here's the story about a little guy that lives in a blue world, and all day and all night, and everything he sees is just blue, like him inside and outside. Blue his house with a blue little window and a blue Corvette, and everything is blue for him and himself and everybody around, 'cause he ain't got nobody to listen to.
I'm blue, I've a need, I've a die, 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 I've a need, I've a die. I'm blue, I've a need, I've a die, 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 I've a need, I've a die.
All right. This is Dylan. Sitting here with Casey.
Hey.
We're going to ask Gabe and Anita a few questions about their pieces that they just shared. I'll start with Gabe, yeah? Gabe, your piece, compared to a lot of the others that we've heard today, there was very little accompaniment to your voice other than a few sounds in the song at the end. Can you talk a little bit about that choice to have it pretty raw?
Sure. So for me, it just felt weird. I tried a few different iterations of it, and I tried editing what I would say or what I said. And for me, it just felt more natural to have it be this long, raw tape that has a lot of vocal blemishes, so to speak. It just felt really good to keep it raw and unedited. I don't really know what else to say to that, other than it felt right.
What was the significance of the song at the end?
Okay, yeah, so that's a really good question. So it started off as being kind of this, I guess we kind of just did it because we all in the group really liked the song. And it was also like an interesting juxtaposition to have these very contrasting feels. You know, this is like a catchy pop song from the 90s, and here we are talking about these pretty personal things. But upon really listening to the lyrics in the song, it kind of captured something. I'm being serious here, in that like the lyrics are about this person who, based on what they are thinking, sees the world and everything in that world as being blue, as being the same. And I think a lot of the pieces here we're sharing are kind of these things that like happen to us and how it influences how we end up seeing the world in turn of that. And yeah. So I found that to be an interesting metaphor. And the song itself kind of is a metaphor because it's presenting that message in a very upbeat pop way. Yeah.
That was a very eloquent answer. Thank you so much. I'm going to turn the mic over to Casey now.
Hey, all right, so we're going to be talking about Anita's piece now. I think the first thing that really hits me in the piece is how you overlay the Spanish and the English. And I was just wondering what you thought while you were doing that about accessibility in the piece, and just like how you mixed it, the volumes of the Spanish versus the English, and what your process was like doing that.
Yeah, I'm really glad you actually noticed that, Casey, because I didn't really know how to do this, but like what I was talking about, which is linguistic imperialism, is essentially, you know, that, you know, like putting some languages over others, right? And the way my piece ends is, you know, saying in Spanish that, you know, English is more important than Spanish. And what I do throughout the whole piece is pretty much I just, like, make the Spanish, like, in a much lower volume, and then the English is louder, even though in many cases it's the same, just me speaking and, like, translating what I'm saying in English into Spanish or vice versa, because I think I did it kind of, like, I wrote my script in kind of, like, Spanglish, and then I translated into both. Yeah. But, and then I decided to end it in Spanish, kind of like to, kind of, I guess, like make some kind of statement that I don't agree with those dynamics.
So was doing audio a new language for you working with this piece?
Yep. I don't know if you could tell, but I'm not that good at editing yet, but I did really enjoy it. And actually, I feel like making audio pieces for this class kind of like made me want to like try other media. So yeah, it was definitely a different, you know, language for me, because I usually like express everything either like in writing or like speaking. I talk a lot. But now I kind of want to, you know, I'm doing like more like video editing and stuff like that that I had never done before, and audio editing, which is cool.
Great, thank you. Should we do a group question? So I have a question for both of you, actually. I was wondering, like, what's some, like, one big struggle you found working with these pieces?
The middle names. It was definitely a struggle to find middle names that suited all of us. But I feel like Gabe can tell you a little bit more about that.
Well, I think we just thought it was, you know, fun to create kind of a nickname or middle name to capture our personas. And I think they did just that. Sorry, what was the question? Can you repeat it?
What's one big struggle you found making these pieces?
Actually getting down to recording it and hearing yourself say these things out loud, I guess. And not only that, but saying them multiple times and then hearing them multiple times and sharing them multiple times, I guess.
Yeah, I agree, although for me it was more sharing it. Making it is kind of fun. I mean, took me a long time, but like right now when I listen to it in front of everyone, I literally close my eyes and pretend I was sleeping because I don't want to make eye contact with anyone while they're listening to my piece. But I guess that's just me. I don't know.
It wasn't just you, because I saw a number of people texting while their own pieces were playing.
Or just pretending to text, as it was in my case. I really thought you were sleeping, Anita.
Okay, any more questions?
No.
Oh. So I think that brings us to the end of our 4-hour almost marathon broadcast of Personal Political, also known as Poetic Political. And it's been such an honor to work with this crew of students. And so I want to express my deep gratitude for being part of this journey with you. And I'm excited for all of you as you go forward with these wonderful skills and stories. So thanks, everybody.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.